Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, an original production from KJZZ. Every weekday, we bring you the latest news and culture from across the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, state lawmakers are expected to debate further changes to the initiative process.
And are there new efforts to ratify? There are new efforts to ratify the Equal Rights Amendment, but is it necessary anymore?
But first, the deadline came and went, and there's no deal on Colorado River water. Arizona and six other states that rely on the shrinking river failed to meet a Valentine's Day deadline over the weekend to strike a deal about how to share the river's water. 40 million of us rely on water from the Colorado, but climate change is drying up the Great River, and states have to decide how we'll all use less. Only problem is, some states don't seem to be willing to shoulder the cuts. KJZZ's Alex Hager has been covering it all, and he's in studio now to tell us more. Good morning, Alex.
Good morning, Lauren.
Okay, so no deal. One negotiator called this extremely frustrating, I think was the quote.
Yeah.
Tell us what happened here.
Well, basically, the states have spent the better part of the last 2 years stuck along a major ideological disagreement. Basically, who should have to feel the pain of these water cutbacks that we know are necessary to deal with a shrinking river? There have been tiny little glimmers of optimism along the way, but basically, the states drew lines in the sand very early on and said, we are willing to sacrifice this much water, we are willing to sacrifice this much water, and have not really moved past that, especially because one of those groups, we are willing to sacrifice this much water, is basically no mandatory cuts.
Right, mandatory cuts. Okay, and this goes back to this whole division between upper basin states, lower basin states. We are one of the lower basin states. Tell us about what everyone's demanding here.
Well, basically, the lower basin states, that's Arizona, California, and Nevada, have put forth some mandatory cuts in years where there is not enough water to fill the West's major reservoirs. The upper basin states have said, we are not going to do the same because, they say, Colorado, Wyoming, Utah, and New Mexico, they are legally required to send a certain amount of water downstream to the lower basin every year. So they say, we are already taking cuts because when Mother Nature gives us less snow in our mountains, we have less water to send down, and the remaining balance is less for us.
Okay, so Mother Nature taking the cuts for them. What did Arizona's water leaders have to say after this deadline passed and there was again no deal, Alex?
Around the West, water leaders came out with rather pointy elbows. We have seen a lot of statements over the past few months that have said something along the lines of, well, we're optimistic about the direction this is going. We're hopeful that we could reach a deal. But after this missed deadline, the tone definitely changed. We saw that here in Arizona. Tom Buschatsky, the head of the Department of Water Resources, he's the one who does all the negotiating for our state. He said numerous good faith compromises to the representatives of the upper basin states have been made, and in this time, virtually all of them have been rejected. He said Arizona cannot be asked to sacrifice its water security while receiving virtually nothing in return. These are sharp statements. They are statements that make clear how divided these states are.
Right. And at the same time, you had statements from upper basin leaders saying they think they're the ones who are kind of facing reality, the reality of the shrinking river. How is that possible?
Yeah, at a time when the states really do need to come together to forge a deal to avoid some really negative consequences, we are seeing only sort of increasing tensions between them.
Okay. Without another deal, this is another missed deadline. What happens now? We're looking at the Fed stepping in. Pretty much we're going to end up in court is what people are saying.
That is what happens if there is no deal. The silver lining is that there is still some time. So the current rules for managing the river expire in October of this year. Once they expire, there are guidelines, but they're very old guidelines for managing the river. So the federal government has come up with a plan that says, look, we need to make sure that there is enough water in Lake Powell and Lake Mead, the two largest reservoirs in the country, to keep the dams working, to keep hydroelectric turbines running, to keep water passing from one side of the dam to the other.
Right.
The federal government does not want to let those dams stop working. So they have come up with their own plan. However, it requires cutting back on some of the water that both groups of states get to use, and both groups of states are likely to be unhappy, or at the very least one group of state, and there would be lawsuits from the states to the federal government, maybe even between the states, and those would end up in the Supreme Court. And that would get really messy. The states have all said that they want to avoid that outcome, but the way to avoid that outcome is coming to an agreement amongst themselves, which they can't seem to do.
Tell us, Alex, about the plans that have come forward so far from the federal government. Arizona does not fare well in those, right?
No. There is a longstanding legal principle that means that generally when there are times of shortage on the Colorado River, it is users in Arizona that are going to feel most of the pain. It's the Central Arizona Project. It's a big canal that supplies the Phoenix Metro, Tucson, and some other parts of Arizona. And under a lot of the federal plans, the deepest cuts would be to the Central Arizona Project. The leader of the Central Arizona Project came out and said cuts as they're outlined right now by the federal government would be devastating to Arizona. She said, it appears that they are trying to wipe us off the map.
I mean, wow.
If there isn't an agreement among the states, that is going to show up in our backyard here.
Okay, and if we end up in a court battle, which lots of folks think could happen, Arizona might have a tough time faring in that as well, right?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. But I think we would see a lot of legal action trying to protect Arizona's water, and there's not really a great sense of telling how that would go right now.
Okay. So looking at a short-term deal for now, is that a possibility that seems like it's pretty likely?
If we are going to see a deal at this point, it seems like it's going to be a short-term deal. State leaders have come out and said, you know, we at one point were trying to look at something that would last decades into the future, but right now the priority is sort of patching up the system and making sure that these reservoirs stay alive and also giving ourselves a little bit of flexibility. So 5 years down the road, we can see how much water there is. We can see how the cutbacks we instituted in a short-term sense actually worked. And so I think if we're going to see a deal between now and October, states have made it very clear that it's something that might last 5 years, mm-hmm. 2 years, even 1 year.
Okay. So it could be very short. Okay. And Alex, this all comes as we are experiencing this like record dry winter in the West, in the Rockies, especially, which is where the snowpack for the Colorado comes from. How does that play into this whole conversation?
Well, it makes it even more urgent. I think that, you know, sometimes there's a hope in discussions about the Colorado River that maybe the water will come back enough to save us from making these difficult decisions about our demand.
Yeah.
That is not the case this year. We are seeing some of the worst data about how much water is available in the Colorado River system going back into the 80s when they started keeping track of this stuff.
Wow.
And because of that, it means that Mother Nature is not going to save these reservoirs, add more water to stop the infrastructure issues. The solutions are going to come from people, or they're going to have to come from people. And right now, those people can't agree.
Right now, those people cannot agree. Alex Hager, KJZZ's water reporter, joining us. Alex, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Lauren.
Friday is the last day for lawmakers to hear bills in committees in their chambers of origin, House bills in House committees, Senate bills in Senate committees. And that means some of those panels this week will be working through pretty long agendas. With me now, as he is every Monday during the legislative session, to talk about what to expect this week at the state capitol is Howie Fisher of Capitol Media Services. Howie, good morning.
Good morning. Here we are again, and we're hoping we're going to move a bunch of bills out, and the birds will sing, and the bees will buzz, and we'll see unicorns.
You've been covering the Capitol a long time, Howie. Has that ever actually happened?
No.
Okay,
no.
Just checking.
And I'd be willing to bet that even though theoretically, according to the legislative calendar, this is the last week for each chamber to hear bills in its own committees, that there will be more next week.
Absolutely.
The sheer number of bills that they have kind of says that's not going to happen.
Yeah. Okay. So let's talk about a few that will be heard this week. And one of them is dealing with the initiative process. Lawmakers over the years have changed the rules for voting for groups of voters to put issues on the ballot. What are some of the changes that they're considering this time around?
Well, we start off with the premise that lawmakers, particularly those in the Republican Party, and particularly the people who put them in office, usually the business community, don't like people making their own laws. I mean, you know, if you're not going through the legislature and not providing campaign contributions, how dare these people? So that's how we got, for example, minimum wage. That's how we got medical marijuana. That's how we got recreational marijuana and a whole bunch of other things. That's how we got the Heritage Fund. So over the years, as you point out, there have been efforts to kind of curtail that. Some of it they would have to take back to voters. For example, a couple of years ago, they said normally you require 10% of signatures cast for last governor's race statewide. And they want to say it's got to be 10% from each of the 15 counties. And voters said, I don't think so. And they rejected it by a wide margin. This year, they're back with something a little different that doesn't require to go to the voters. This year it says that if you are a paid circulator, and you already have to disclose that, now you have to wear a badge with your name on it and saying what state you're from, under the presumption that people say, you're from New York. Oh, my God, we would never sign anything. You know, failing to recognize that paid circulators have become part of the issue since it takes perhaps 500,000 signatures to get a constitutional amendment on the ballot. Hmm. Now, the future of that, I'd say there may be the votes in the Republican-controlled legislature for that. Again, it doesn't go to the voters, and it'll be up to folks to decide, are you willing to reelect folks who have made it harder for you to make your own laws?
Right. Howie, let me ask you about a bill that would set aside a pretty decent chunk of change to reimburse counties and cities that put up border fences in areas that have high crossings for illegal immigrants.
Yeah, this is interesting because of the fact that, as we all know from watching the news, border crossings are way down, both in terms of human smuggling and drug smuggling. In fact, the new drug smuggling thing has been the drones, as we saw over the weekend with the question of whether they're trying to shoot them down with lasers over El Paso. And yet, there seems to be a very political purpose behind this. I don't doubt that there are areas somewhere along the border, you know, perhaps down in the rural sections of Cochise County, that you might have crossings. But again, they've been down to virtually zero. So I can't help but believe that this is more of a political thing to somehow get money to counties and to county sheriff's departments to go ahead and say, look, we want to do more enforcement. And it's a very popular issue, you know, secure the border, of course. I mean, even Katie Hobbs is saying, look, I'm voting to secure the border. I'm working to secure the border. So I think this is more eyewash than anything else, given, again, look at how much fence has gone up, even with the federal government. And in fact, as Trump just signed some legislation to go ahead and repurpose some steel that wasn't used the last time.
Howie, safe to say, though, that since this is a money bill, that even if the bill passes, it would have to be worked into the budget later this session?
Oh, definitely. I mean, anything with money on it doesn't go anywhere until the budget is approved. Then you have to decide, well, what are the priorities? Well, first of all, we haven't even decided what tax breaks we're giving. Is it going to be $250 million a year? Is it going to be $440 million a year? And what money is coming in, as we've talked about, you know, the budget that the governor has is built on $760 million coming from the federal government to reimburse us for the last stuff we did, including that ersatz border wall that Doug Ducey put up using storage containers. Mm. There's also some other things in there about, you know, we're going to curb vouchers, which, again, hasn't gone anywhere, but the governor's budgeted $80 million for that. So you're right. We have to figure out how much we're willing to spend and how much we're willing to save for tax cuts. And that's going to be a real hard one for some of the Republicans to say, okay, we're going to not do $20 million in certain kinds of tax cuts because we want to give some money for border walls.
Yeah. Howie, speaking of the budget, there's a proposal to ask voters whether or not they should approve a plan to basically say if the legislature and the governor do not come up with a budget by the end of April, those folks don't get paid?
Well, as somebody who's been covering the legislature into June and sometimes July, I'd say it's got my vote. you know, there are a lot of reasons it doesn't get done by April 30th. Part of it has been the volatility of the economy. And it makes a lot of sense to say, you know, you really need to have something done by a certain date and get the heck out of Dodge. That just hasn't happened, you know, since the 1980s. And a lot of it is a lot of freshman lawmakers say, but I have another bill I need heard, which is part of, you know, why I say I don't think we're done with bill hearings quite yet. There's some interesting problems with this. For example, it says not only do legislators not get paid, but the governor doesn't get paid. Okay, well, the governor's part of it, but it also says the secretary of state doesn't get paid or the school superintendent doesn't get paid. Why? How is it their fault that there is no state budget? And yet there's a curious flaw in the law. Everyone seems to have forgotten that as of this election, we're going to have a lieutenant governor. There's nowhere in the bill that says the lieutenant governor doesn't get paid. So that might be the best job in the state if, in fact, this thing passes, because lieutenant governor is going to be the only one saying, hey, I'm being paid. I don't care.
And somebody somewhere is now furiously drafting an amendment to this proposal, I would assume, right?
Oh, definitely. I think that if it gets out in the form that it's in, somebody's going to say, excuse me.
Yeah, interesting. All right. Lots to watch. As always, that is Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services. Howie, thank you. Really appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, a book of poetry, news clippings, and ephemera paints a portrait of a childhood in Tombstone. We'll hear from the author of a new memoir that stitches memory to prose.
But first, it is a busy time for immigration attorneys. With President Trump's mass deportation campaign picking up and raids in cities across the country, they're getting swamped with calls and, according to our next guest, sometimes have to turn folks away. Juliana Manzanares is a Valley immigration attorney and founder of Via Law Group. She told me seemingly constant rule changes and sped up timelines from the federal government are making it more difficult.
We're all stretched pretty thin, especially those that do deportation defense, those that take cases for people that are detained. Those timelines are really fast, so that's what makes us even more slammed.
And it sounds like that's happening more often. These timelines are getting sped up by the federal government. The rules are changing. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so there's a couple of different rules that are changing for practitioners. So one of them is on the detain side. Whenever you go in to ask for a continuance, because maybe it's going to be your first appearance, you might have gotten like a month or a month and a half, nothing incredibly long. Now the rules are you're not going to get more than 2 weeks.
Okay.
So now we're essentially going through whole cases from the beginning to trial in about a month and a half.
Wow.
Appellate rules recently changed without warning. They published in the Federal Register rules and regulations, because that's where we get our power from, that instead of 30 days for a notice of appeal that you want to appeal your case, you get 10 days.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not an automatic, we'll get you the transcripts, we'll issue you some dates for you to submit your arguments in writing. It's, well, if all the judges on the Board of Immigration Appeals don't want to hear the case, we're just going to dismiss it outright in 15 days after that 10-day notice.
Wow.
So now it's less than a month where supposedly there's appellate review for somebody.
Are you mostly getting no's?
Right now, yes.
I think one of the things that gets lost in the conversation about immigration and deportation is that it's more complicated than someone is here legally or someone mm-hmm. is here illegally, right?
Yeah.
Tell us about that middle ground.
Yeah. So there are so many factors that go into whether somebody can apply for residency or not. And I think that's the main thing is people, the general public that I've seen and ask me these questions as well is, well, they should just apply for citizenship. Well, we can't even get there if they're not a green card holder or yeah. a permanent resident. And there's so many barriers to get there in terms of regulations, what Congress has approved in 97 that haven't been updated for today's time. There are backlogs depending on, you know, who's petitioning who
yeah.
for that. And it can be a process of a year and a half if they're able to do everything from here within the United States, or it could be up to 8 years if they have to go back to their country for that interview. There's so many nuances.
Hmm.
And then we have an administration that isn't necessarily changing who can apply, but they are changing what they decide to focus on those applications.
Hmm.
So the White House can't change, you know, a U.S. citizen spouse trying to get a green card for their spouse, right?
Right.
What they can change is, well, how much money does that U.S. citizen have to make?
Hmm.
Has the person that's applying for the immigration benefit ever, you know, received some sort of emergency access?
Hmm.
If that's the case, can we impose a fine? These fines have now gone up. Application fees have gone up.
Yeah. So part of the Trump administration's efforts to restrict legal immigration in this way as well, making it more difficult, different mm-hmm. different guidelines, et cetera. One thing that you've mentioned is that you're seeing more people trying to apply for citizenship, people mm-hmm. who are eligible for citizenship, mm-hmm. but maybe didn't get around to it. It's expensive. It takes a long
yeah.
time.
Yeah. We saw that also during Trump 1.0.
Mm.
So I think it's somewhat fear-driven. Lawful permanent residents do carry, I would say, extra protections than maybe other types of people that are applying. And as they see enforcement ramping up in different cities, I get a lot of people that have been eligible to apply for many years
mm-hmm.
that are ready to do it now.
Hmm.
Usually what I get is, well, I've been a resident for a really long time. I travel in and out of the United States as I'm allowed to do, and now I'm getting questioned more and more
hmm.
at the border or at airports about things that happened 30 years ago. why is that? And it's me explaining, well, every time you come in, you're asking for permission to come in as a lawful permanent resident. The way to avoid that is to become a U.S. citizen. And that's generally now what they're afraid of. Are they going to take my residency away for something that I did 20, 30 years ago that's already been disclosed, adjudicated? This government has decided it wasn't enough to take it away.
So a lot of fear there. Tell us about the process to become a citizen.
The rules are you have to at least be a resident for 5 years.
Okay.
You have to be able to take a civics exam, which this administration has changed, and an English exam.
Okay.
And then they review your application. They're going to ask how you became a resident, your addresses, biographical information, have you been arrested, things along those lines.
Yeah.
They have to prove good moral character. So the way that they've changed that a little bit is instead of 10 questions that they're asking for the civics exam, they're asking 12.
How often or does it ever happen that folks are, you know, eligible for citizenship, apply and are denied?
Yeah, for different reasons. Maybe they didn't get enough questions right on the civics exam. Maybe they didn't pass the English portion. That just means that they get to come again in a few months and try again.
Okay.
Sometimes you're denied because you had some criminal activity in the last 5 years that the officer deemed wasn't good moral character. And we're talking about criminal activity from, you know, like a DUI all the way up to, you know, some other felonies that wouldn't necessarily place you in immigration proceedings. But they're going to look at all of that in the last 5 years.
Yeah.
Or if there's a reason that, which is the most serious, if there's a reason that they believe that you shouldn't have become a permanent resident in the first place, that's where people should really be worried.
Let me talk about that fear with you a little bit. Like in the community in general, in the immigrant community here, I think the last time we heard a lot about fear of deportation, of ICE, of law enforcement in general was 15 years ago when SB 1070 had been passed and you had Sheriff Joe Arpaio then, you know, patrolling Latino neighborhoods and arresting people for traffic infractions and things like that. I wonder if it sounds like that again to a lot of folks right now.
It does. I think when I talk to my other colleagues, as well as also just people that were involved in that movement, there's very similar parallels in terms of what we've seen. However, I think the big difference is that was on a local level, and there was always some sort of comfort that we still had the backing of district courts and federal governments, and there was still a resource in that judiciary. And I'm not saying that there isn't now, but it is very hard to think that way when a lot of opinions from different courts are coming down not necessarily in favor of what we're asking for. And they don't have to reinvent the wheel here, right? They have a way to look back and say, well, this is what Sheriff Joe did. Why don't we just go ahead and do that again? Do I think that that's a possibility that it might happen? Yes. Are we seeing it as heavy now? No. Do I think it's coming? Yes.
Right. I'll leave it there. Juliana Manzanares joining us, an immigration attorney, founder of Via Law Group. Thank you so much for coming in, Juliana. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Democrats at the Arizona State Legislature are attempting to make our state the latest to ratify the Equal Rights Amendment. It's an effort that goes back to the 1920s, passed Congress in the 1970s, and stalled in the years after that. In order to become the 28th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, it would need to be ratified by 38 states. And that happened just a few years ago when Virginia ratified it in 2020. But there is still legal opposition to the official adoption of the ERA. And our next guest is here to explain where it stands now and what efforts to continue to pass it still mean today. Mako Ward is an assistant professor of African American and Women and Gender Studies in ASU School of Social Transformation. I spoke with her more about it.
I think the ERA was and continues to be part of the long history of civil rights in the United States. It was first drafted in 1923 by suffragist Alice Paul. And Paul and other suffragists, other women's rights activists, really believed that the right to vote which was the 19th Amendment that passed in 1920, that the right to vote was just the first step.
Right.
And there needed to be full legal equality under the law that required constitutional protection. Right. And it wasn't until 1972,
right,
after the amendment passed with the two-thirds majority in both chambers of the Congress, that it was sent to the states. And 30 states chose to ratify the legislation. And by 1978, 35 states had ratified the legislation. And that was just shy of the required 38.
Right.
38 states need to ratify.
Going way back in American history here, the 38 states. But
absolutely,
something kind of shifted as the states were kind of tasked with this final step of ratifying it, right?
Right, right. So in 1979, Congress set a deadline, mm-hmm, for the states to finally ratify. But what we know to be true is that there's no deadline stipulated in the U.S. Constitution. But to the point, Congress set a deadline in 1979. President Jimmy Carter extended that deadline to 1982. And it was between 2007 and 2020 that the additional three states ratified the amendment, bringing us to the threshold. In 2020, right, it was Virginia. So the 38-state threshold for the ERA to become a constitutional amendment passed.
It's almost a 100-year process right,
yeah,
there.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
But it's still not in place because of various legal challenges. Where does, mm-hmm, it stand today?
Mm-hmm. So I think the political issue right now is that the congressional deadline and the extension have passed. Mm-hmm. And so there's that contention. So in 2023, the U.S. Court of Appeals in the District of Columbia, they ruled that the congressional deadline was legally binding.
Sure.
So that's the sort of really specific piece that's holding things up. The other interesting piece to this is the role of the U.S. archivist.
Hmm.
And the U.S. archivist functions to certify that the amendment is part of the Constitution.
Yeah.
The archivist, it's a nonpartisan appointed position. Last March, our current president fired then archivist Dr. Colleen Shogan and appointed Secretary of State Marco Rubio as the acting archivist. So that move can be interpreted as inevitably turning the position into a more partisan, heated political position.
So various reasons why, yeah, the ERA is still not official constitutional law in the United,
right,
States of America in 2026.
Mm-hmm.
What would it mean at this point if it were to pass these legal thresholds, actually, you know, become a part of the Constitution to you? What would it mean, mm-hmm, you think, in the course of women's rights history in this country?
The ERA, it resonates beyond these sort of congressional and constitutional technicalities. It, mm-hmm, would enshrine a constitutional guarantee of gender equality, something that is not explicitly present in our original Constitution. It would also guarantee equal rights under the law for all persons, regardless of sex.
Mm-hmm.
So my earlier point about the ERA being part of a longer civil rights history, I do think it's really important to reframe our conversations. While the ERA is rooted in the movement for women's rights in the U.S., what we know to be true about that movement is that it has always historically been intersectional,
mm-hmm,
meaning it has always had points of relationality and connection to the civil rights movement. And so I choose to sort of frame these moves towards equal protection under the law, whether it's around gender or around racial identity or other forms of difference. These are all part of a longer history of civil rights in the United States.
Mm.
And so to guarantee equal rights under the law, regardless of sex, means that we would expand constitutional protections for not only women, but members of the LGBTQIA plus community, specifically people who identify as non-binary,
right,
or transgender.
Right. So the question of identifying equal rights for gender is very different than it was, you know, in the 70s or in the 1920s when this was originally, mm-hmm, conceived. I wonder what you think that says about the broader conversation about what women's rights or the quote unquote women's rights movement even means in America today.
Right. I think that the broader political climate really shows why the ERA is needed,
mm,
right? The use of the power of the political sphere and the power of Congress to, for example, roll back funding for health care, to criminalize miscarriage care, to restrict voting access. What we are witnessing is the misuse of one of – at this point, I would argue all branches of government in order to curtail or limit access to rights and curtail and limit the ability for all people residing here in the United States to receive protection under the Constitution. Mm. So the ERA, I think, is one additional step among many towards ensuring that the U.S. Constitution does its job, which is protect the bodies and the bodily autonomy of all people here in the United States.
It's so interesting because I think that's the reason it's so political today, right? Like conservatives will say this is not about women's rights. It's about abortion or LGBTQ rights or things that are not explicitly said here. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like you agree. It is.
I would argue that it is about the equal protection of all people under the law, under the greatest law of the land, which is the U.S. Constitution.
Right. So that's interesting because a lot of the argument about this right now will say, mm-hmm. we just don't need this anymore. Like there are lots of other laws that protect women's rights. Like this is unnecessary.
Right.
So what would you like to see happen at this moment? Like Arizona and local kind of Democratic leaders here making an effort to ratify the ERA, even though, you know, the 38 states have done it. Mm-hmm. Is that just symbolic to you? Do you think it would mean something?
I think we're at a point where it's a both and. Mm. You know, as states continue the momentum towards ratifying the ERA, because I do think it is more than symbolic. It is a structural demonstration that state legislatures have the power to protect their citizenry, right? And to protect the civil and equal rights of their citizenry. But it also requires a move on the part of Congress to make a decision about whether or not they have the power to create deadlines, right? Yeah. So last year, Massachusetts Representative Ayanna Pressley reintroduced a joint resolution to remove this arbitrary deadline that was imposed on the ERA. So it is a both and. The kind of organizing that's happening at the state level needs to continue to happen mm-hmm. because it demonstrates the power of the states. But we also need Congress to do its job, which is to, in this case, create a kind of boundary around its own powers and its own ability to adequately and ethically interpret the U.S. Constitution through the passage of law.
Yeah, very interesting. All right, we'll leave it there. Mako Ward, assistant professor at the School of Social Transformation at ASU, joining us. Thank you, Mako, for coming in. Thanks for talking this through. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Many of us have spent time sitting at a red light, wondering why that light was still red when there was no other traffic going through the intersection. Phoenix is trying to reduce the number of times that happens, in part by using AI. The city has been working with a platform called No Traffic for about 5 years. On its website, the company says, among other benefits, its technology has reduced Phoenix's afternoon commute times by nearly 30%. It also says it's reduced red light running in the city by 70%. Simon Ramos is Phoenix's traffic engineering supervisor. He says while the technology is relatively new and needs vetting, it's also showing a lot of promise. I spoke with Ramos earlier and asked how Phoenix uses AI in its traffic lights.
So in the sense AI, many vendors use this terminology and it's more so, say, adaptive technology. So City of Phoenix has about 1,300 traffic signals, and we have the challenge of managing, operating, and monitoring traffic level congestions with about a team of 6 folks. So we leverage various types of technologies, such as AI/adaptive detection systems. So these smart detection system cameras basically just count vehicles on the roadway, kind of monitor their speeds, monitoring, you know, platoons getting through signals or not. So one of the functions of them is to count the vehicles during the AM and PM and midday rush hours. So a traffic engineer can basically monitor and react to the signal timing in real time. So as far as the AI element, we do have some systems out there that basically react on their own as far as reacting to traffic levels of congestion and on, say, non-reoccurring events such as crashes or collisions or construction projects and such.
So of the 1,300 signals that the city has, how many of them are tied to a camera or some sort of system that allows folks to maybe switch up the timing of when the light changes?
Roughly about 30% of our signals have this type of technology or some type of technology. So the smart cameras or the video detection systems out there, you'll see when you're driving at a signalized intersection, if you look up on the mast arm or the street light, you'll see somewhat of a camera or a dome type device pointed at the vehicles themselves. That's basically the number one function is it's detecting if a vehicle is there or not. So that way the controller or the computer on the corner of the intersection basically provides that green time to the vehicles by demand.
So just to make sure I'm understanding, at one of these intersections that has a camera like this, it will look and see how heavy the traffic is, maybe how many cars are looking to be backed up or might be backed up at a red light. And the AI doesn't change the lights, right? It tells you or your colleagues in the operations center, look, we've got to, maybe we want to make the red light a little shorter here, or we need to keep traffic moving through this intersection. And then a human is still responsible for changing it. Is that right?
Somewhat. We do have some of these types of cameras, and this is a different group of cameras that we're piloting, evaluating with our partners here in the Valley. So some of these do actually adapt to traffic levels and adapt the signal timing or adjust the signal timing on their own.
Really? And how many of those do you have?
We just finished a pilot or a project of roughly about 30 intersections. We're doing research also with the University of Arizona on another study for red light running and monitoring and studying driver behavior. I believe that's another 20, 25 intersections as well.
Hmm.
So they're scattered throughout the city.
What did you find in those 30 intersections or so, 30 lights, where the AI was basically changing the lights on its own?
We did find some benefit. Obviously, with any new technology, it's going to take some, tweaking of the technology or their algorithms to kind of better improve. So obviously, it's not going to be as good as somebody monitoring traffic in real time. So that would equate to an individual, monitoring 5 or 10 signals at once and having, control of them and being able to make those timing changes on the fly.
But as you say, there are 6 of you, right? So, I mean, that's
correct.
1,300 signals is a lot for 6 humans to be monitoring. Is this the kind of thing where automation makes sense in terms of trying to keep traffic moving and do jobs that, in your case, humans like just don't have the capacity to do right now?
Correct. For a city this large, yes.
You mentioned that there are some tweaks that you have to make. I'm curious what kinds of issues, even if they're sort of minor issues, you've run into.
So how this technology works is more using kind of machine learning algorithms. So you'd have to teach that technology exactly what it's looking at as far as identifying pedestrians crossing the road versus, is it a car or is it a bus, things like that. Some other types where, it may, think that it identified a collision, which in effect it didn't. So at the end of the day, somebody has to go in and validate what the camera is seeing or marking as a collision.
And what is the end goal here? I mean, do you envision a time when all of the city's traffic lights are controlled by AI?
So I guess in a, say, perfect world, if we do have this technology deployed at all 1,300 of our signals, we would rely on this technology as far as the data that it would provide us. So we can make, sound engineering decisions to make improved countermeasures at the intersections. So they can kind of help us identify which signals are, for example, have red light running events or which signals are prone to accidents, which signals, have higher vehicle counts, which ones have, more pedestrians. And then that data is then, kind of vetted and evaluated through traffic engineers to make better decisions on, say, infrastructure, striping, signing, things that such.
Have you found that these platforms provide that kind of data so far?
Yes.
And has it been useful?
It has. When we're referring to the no traffic and the project that we're working with the University of Arizona, you know, 20 years ago, we would not be able to collect this type of data, but we can actually determine, you know, when the yellow light comes on, you know, what exactly is the driver doing? Are they trying to accelerate and beat the red light? Or are they, in fact, trying to, you know, not enter the intersection or reduce their speeds? That tells us, you know, if it is, in fact, you know, vehicles making an attempt to not run the red light, but they just don't get it in time, then basically we would start looking at our signal timing. Do we need to reevaluate how long that yellow should be so the vehicle can either safely stop or safely get through that intersection?
Are there any safety concerns that you have or you have noticed with this technology? And I'm thinking especially of the signals that are not being switched by humans.
So, well, as far as safety issues, so all of our signals are timed by to national standards. So a yellow time is calculated, you know, by a person and then vetted, and then that gets deployed out in the field. That time serves every single time. That goes the same for pedestrian time to walk across the street. So we haven't fully relied on a pedestrian walking up to the corner of the intersection. The intersection will still be equipped with a push button to guarantee the pedestrian gets enough time to cross the street and road. Now, the addition to that, if the pedestrian does not have enough time to cross, that detection system will then kick in, determine someone's still in the crosswalk or something is still in the crosswalk, and provide that extra time. But there's fail safes and timing parameters that are put in place to ensure that the intersections are still operating per safety standards.
Simon Ramos is the traffic engineering supervisor for the city of Phoenix.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. In his new memoir, Reckon, poet Logan Phillips plays with form in a variety of ways. The book weaves together Phillips' poetry, prose, old photographs, newspaper clippings, restaurant ads, and more, creating a pastiche of life in 1980s and 90s Tombstone, where Phillips grew up. It's a project that plays with how and why certain memories are preserved at the expense of others. Phillips recently spoke with our co-host Sam Dingman and began by reading a passage from the book.
History is an old theater, turned museum, turned replica desert evening, where kid me steps on a hidden switch and a coyote calls from a tape loop. History auto-rewinds, unseen, beneath a fiberglass boulder. Backstage, in the archive, history is just what Dad did. Taught himself to build exhibits, how to spell letter by letter the text given to him. Taxonomy, taxidermy, hawk, skunk, rattlesnake den. Who won what war when? History is not what happened, but how it is told on Take Your Son to Work Day.
Thank you for reading that. It expresses a couple things that it seems to me you're playing with in this book. Among them, a very poetic tone and writing style, and also this larger idea of Tombstone and maybe the West more broadly as a kind of hybrid environment, both a real place where people have lives and are raised, but also there's this way in which history has transformed them into a kind of stage set.
Absolutely. You know, and what's so interesting about that is that it was happening, you know, at the time that the quote unquote history was made, right? The story of the place preceded the creation of the place in some ways, right? Stories of silver, of treasure, of these things. And that continues today with the myth making about the past that obscures or emphasizes certain aspects of it.
Yes. Well, and one of the other ways that you accomplish this, in addition to the poetic writing, is you have all of these really amazing newspaper clippings from the Tombstone epitaph. And also there's like restaurant ads and I think some brochures maybe in there, all of which reinforce the nature and tone of the stories that are told about Tombstone by the residents of Tombstone, and you know the way that local restaurants and tourist attractions kind of play on these myths of the West. What was interesting to you about weaving those materials in to kind of buttress your own recollections?
We're never writing without context, right? We're surrounded by our lived experience, but also by all of the work that is happening around us at the same time. You know, a newspaper to me, this in some ways, this book is a celebration of newspaper. The Tombstone Epitaph local edition that was published throughout this period in the 1980s and 1990s was actually a student project from students at the University of Arizona who spent an incredible amount of time and effort being in Tombstone and reporting on local news. And, you know, the depth that they reached in these editions, you know, rivals some of the best local reporting that we see today. And so it's, you know, hearkening back to this time when communities really had the opportunity to tell their own stories and people's lives were seen as noteworthy, not just for their controversies.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to ask you about one particular juxtaposition that I found quite moving in the book. This is from sort of early on. And you have printed next to each other a letter to the editor from somebody named Billy Malier. And then next to that, you have a Xerox, it looks like, of a document that you wrote, it looks like, for school in 1992. And the letter from Billy Malier reads in part, "Dear editor, I'm writing to you in the hopes that you will have the kindness in your heart to place my letter in your newspaper in hopes someone who might be kind to me will write me back." And I'm skipping ahead a little bit here, but then he continues, "I have never felt so lonely in my whole life and so sad. I don't have anyone to write to." And then next to that, we have your writing, again from 1992, when you were a kid. And among other things, you write, "I feel needed here. I am happy here. I am free, free, free." What was interesting to you about putting those two pieces next to each other?
One of the ways that poetry gains energy is through the action of juxtaposition and the energy generated by contradiction. And, you know, going to metaphor, the two halves of a metaphor, what's interesting is kind of the third thing that results from those two pieces. And so to me, some of that happens, you know, in a way that I can't really intellectualize. It's part of the creative process where these things kind of appear or present themselves. And there's something happening there that I don't quite understand myself. And so it's, you know, a real interesting thought experiment to think about, you know, the different paths that lives take and how they might intersect, you know, at a moment, in a place, in a time.
Okay, that makes sense. And I mean, I guess what that made me think about looking at those two things together was this sense of Tombstone in some ways having such a clear identity. You know, this is the place where the famous gunfight happened. This is the place of kind of cowboy identity. But that clearly the truth, as it always is, of what that can mean for people, that can either feel like something that includes them or excludes them. And that makes me think about another passage from the book I was hoping to have you read. This is from a chapter called "Hey There, Cowboy." And in part, what you're doing in this passage is reacting to this old image of a guy in a cowboy hat squatting down. He's got a cigarette in his left hand. He's got a can of what looks like beer in his left hand. And you're writing about just being very compelled by this image in ways you can't fully express.
Yeah, that does present it real well. And that's another photo from that same edition of the newspaper. And so that newspaper that my mom had saved really became kind of a lens or a kaleidoscope to look at my life through. So I was kind of writing to all the different images and articles and things. But I'll go ahead and read this section here.
Yeah.
"My queerness is like my cowboyness. It's just there. I don't need to always wear my boots to have been born in Tombstone. So many people I love hold their queerness central to their identities, and I get it. I love it. Be visible and unapologetic and let people just get cut looking. But do I get to call myself queer? I mean, I'm partner to a person who also questions the assumptions of being called a woman. We have kids. I'm a young father. I pass. I rarely get called out on the street. Most of the men I've loved were beyond my reach. So just who do I think I am? There's so many lines in the sand. I don't know what to tell you, other than I want to buy that man a beer.
Well, I have been speaking with Logan Phillips, the author of Reckon, a memoir which is a hybrid, as we've been discussing, of personal narrative, poetry, and mixed media. And he will be at Changing Hands, the Tempe location, on February 25th. Logan, thank you for this conversation.
Thanks so much for having me, Sam.
All right, that'll do it for today's edition of the show. We will, of course, be back with you again tomorrow morning with much more. And remember, you can sign up for the show's weekly newsletter. It is called Radioheads, and you can sign up at theshow.kjzz.org. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram. We are at KJZZ, the show. For Mark Brody and Sam Dingman, I'm Lauren Gilger. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. The show is produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, and Ayanna Hamilton. The show was created by John Hoban. Our executive producer is Amy Silverman.